Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Do you have one friend who can take a handful of chips and happily quit eating while another one just can't stop? Well, Washington University in St. Louis may have found out why this happens. Your first friend could have more of the newly discovered CD36 receptor, which means he can resist fat. The second friend may have less CD36. But for me, the key discovery in this study was that the more fat any of us eat, the less we can resist it, which is terribly unfair. Well, stick around for better news and great eats this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Well, this week it's how to romance the soybean into silken allure, a.k.a. tofu as you have never known tofu. Trust me on this one. Stringing out the Asian theme, I'm putting supermarket soy sauces to the test with a blind tasting, and we will name names. We're getting our hands in the dirt with master gardener and heirloom pioneer Renee Shepherd. She's got her picks of the top seeds to plant this year. And there's a new experience to be had in your own backyard. You've probably been on a sightseeing tour, eating tours, maybe sipped your way through a bar crawl or two. But have you ever done a smell tour? That is, sniffed your way around town? This is Dr. Victoria Henshaw's way of discovering a place. Smell is her nexus. She's based at Manchester University in Northern England, where she researches architecture and urbanism. Victoria, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So how did you get into smell and cities?
Wow. Well, cities are my passion. I've been passionate about cities for many, many years. And my background, I worked in city marketing and I used to manage town centres here in the north of England. And I worked on a lot of large scale city development projects and managed markets and things like that. So I was always really passionate about having a high quality built environment that was very active for people. But I can remember a turning point for myself was when I went to see an author. He's called Charles Landry, and he wrote a book on the art of city making, and he actually talked about the use of colour in different cities, which I know it sounds really obvious today, but at the time I can remember as a young city manager, it really kind of blew my mind and really started getting me to think about different aspects of the city and how we experience them in different ways.
But smell, I mean, colour you would think of, you know, green space you might think of. But smell is not something you think of in city design.
That's correct, yeah, and it's really not a traditional thing we've thought about. And so little being known about smell, what we smell in cities, what role the smell of cities actually plays in our everyday experiences. So one of the reasons that smell's actually particularly important to us is that it offers us a way of connecting to the environment that some of the other senses don't traditionally offer us. So when we think about smells, we breathe them into our bodies, into our lungs, and so smells actually become part of us and actually connect us with the world.
And there is that thing about smell, it's relatively new science, I think, isn't it, about how smell actually connects to areas of our brains that set off emotions and memories.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, it's incredible, really, to think that it wasn't until only the past couple of decades that we've really started to understand how the sense of smell works. Before that, the scientific community was very much in disagreement about the way the sense of smell worked. And now we know that there's this massive association between memory and long-term memory and the sense of smell. And it's just the way that our brains are connected up, really, that the sense of smell, the part of our brain that processes it, is also next to and highly connected with our memory part of our brain. Sometimes someone can be in their 60s, 70s, 80s or 90s and they can detect a smell that they haven't smelt since being a child. And it almost transports them across space and time back to that point in time.
So how would you design a city to incorporate this?
Well, it's a really tough question, and certainly what I'm not about is saying we need to introduce lots of different smells into a city and think about different scenting strategies in terms of new smells, because really what I'd say is our cities have a lot of smells already. Today I was walking around some of our English cities and there are so many different smells, and I think often they're really literally under our noses and we don't consciously recognise that they're there. So our bodies are detecting them and subconsciously processing them, but actually our minds sometimes aren't recognising that. So I'd certainly say to your listeners, when you go out into the city, actually try and think about and concentrate on what you're smelling there, and you'll be amazed really about the amount of smells that you'll probably detect.
You actually do smell tours, right?
That's right, I do, yes.
And you did, I know you did one in Seattle, and I think you did it in an Asian area of Seattle.
That's right, I did. I did an organised tour in Seattle's International District, and it was fascinating. I took a group of around 20 people for a walk around the district, and we had a sniff at what smells we could detect.
And what was that like for them?
Well, it was fascinating, really. We got a real mixture of different people. And, you know, as you'd imagine in Seattle, it was a rainy day to start with. And that itself influenced what we detected on the day, because weather, of course, plays a huge role in what we smell in any kind of environment. So when we started in Seattle, we started in a small community park called Hinghe Park that has this beautiful little community urban park with a pagoda in there, and they often have street markets, etc. And the day that we were there, there wasn't a street market on, and there wasn't particularly a great deal of smells in that area, and it's situated very close to quite a busy road, actually, and that in itself is very telling and offers us insights into what vehicles and traffic, the influence that they're having on our urban environmental experience and smells. The traffic fumes also influence our ability to smell and makes us less likely to be able to detect smells on a temporary basis. But in some of the most highly polluted cities, such as Mexico City, it influences people's ability to smell the world around them on a permanent basis.
Huh. Victoria, thank you very much.
No problem, thank you.
Dr. Victoria Henshaw is a researcher in architecture and urbanism at the University of Manchester in Northern England. Now, for a dish I think she'd find wonderfully fragrant, try our Indian celebration recipe, wedding lamb biryani. It's on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're on the site, check out the rest of our recipe collection, our free podcast, and take a look at our newest project, an ebook called Eating In with Lynn. It's a quarterly publication, kind of a glimpse inside my kitchen. In every issue, you're going to find a menu, recipes, techniques, and ideas. So head to splendidtable.org to find out where you can virtually get your hands on a copy.
As the ground begins to warm up, the wonderful and distinctive smell of wet earth is beginning to come up. And this may be the year for you to suss out a small patch of your own, be it on a windowsill or in a shared garden plot. Well, to get you started and to fill us in on what's new this year, Renee Shepherd of ReneesGarden.com joins us. She's a pioneer in finding the choicest produce from around the world. Renee, it's good to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you, Lynn. I'm really glad to be here.
Now, I figure at this point in your career, you have probably seen it all, but with that in mind, what's new this year?
Well, there's always something new in the world of seeds because there's so much to choose from. I think a couple highlights that I'm looking forward to eating again this spring are beautiful new edible landscaping lettuces, lettuces that are picked for their beauty as well as their flavor and color. Something new in the mustard family, which is arugula that tastes exactly like wasabi that you'd get at a Japanese restaurant. And tiny padrone peppers, which you basically grow, throw in a frying pan, and eat whole. Portuguese kale, a new old vegetable from Portugal that tastes something between collards and kale and is sweeter and easier to grow. And all kinds of new tomatoes. There's always lots of heirlooms that are being rediscovered. Baby Persian cucumbers would be another one that are only grow about 5 inches long, and many, many new vegetables suitable for growing in containers.
So if we were really in a hurry, what would you have us grow for instant gratification?
I think that if you were a relatively new gardener or someone without a lot of space or time, I would definitely encourage you to grow some baby leaf mesclun, which means a mix of fresh greens. There's mesclun mixes that are all lettuces and others that would have things like arugula or Japanese greens mixed in for some spiciness. Or if you wanted to, you could have a container of mixed sweet lettuces of all colors and forms and one of sharper flavored greens like arugula and maizuna and other spicier peppery flavors. And then you would harvest them basically based on how spicy you wanted your salad, more lettuce, less spicy greens, or vice versa.
And then you could pick them, and as you pick them, they keep growing, so you could keep them going for quite a while.
Yeah, it's called the cut and come again method. You prepare the soil, and you sprinkle the seed over fairly thickly like grass seed, cover it lightly, and in about 35 or 40 days, you can make a cutting of the leaves that are by now 4 to 5 inches tall. You leave 1-inch crowns, in other words, leave the bases in the soil and water and fertilize them, and you'll get another harvest out of them. It's a very traditional and very intensive way of growing your own salad, and you get a lot of leaves from a small space.
What's new in herbs?
Well, there's always wonderful herbs that are coming down the pike. Last year, for example, we started selling the hibiscus that you can grow for their calyxes, which is what flavors red zinger tea, for example. And I am now growing some za'atar oregano, which is a wonderful spice that you use in Mediterranean cooking, and we'll have that soon. This year, we introduced an Italian oregano, which has purple flowers and is slightly sweeter than its Greek cousin. So there's many distinctive kinds of herbs to enjoy. Much more interested in things like chervil, Amsterdam cutting celery. There's a celery that you can grow that's easy to grow, like looks like big, tall parsley, uh-huh. But it tastes like celery. And you really don't eat it like you do stalk celery. What you do is pick a big bunch and hang it upside down so it dries in about a week. And then you can use it all winter for soups and stews when celery's real expensive. It has a real clean, deep, rich celery flavor. That's something that you hadn't seen much before here.
Are you seeing any new trends in seeds?
Yes, I would say that there's a lot of new gardeners coming into gardening who want to grow their own food, and there's a real interest in growing food in containers of all kinds in small spaces, of integrating food gardening with ornamental gardening, so the concept of ornamental edibles or edible landscaping, rooftop and vertical gardens. So people are trying to figure out how to grow food and get the benefits of having a garden, which are much more than just growing food, because a garden anywhere makes life better.
Yeah. Oh, Renee, thank you.
Sure.
Renee Shepherd is creator of ReneesGarden.com. Now you can find her spring planting picks and a recipe for melting greens on the website, splendidtable.org. You know, one approach to deciding what to plant, especially if you don't have space or time, is to grow the things that you can't get or that are too expensive. And for instance, mosh salad would be one of my candidates. Mosh has small leaves and they taste as though mild bib got together with tart endive. I like to mix it with thin sliced snow peas and lemon and olive oil. And sweet Italian frying peppers are another pick. They're mild, so they never take over a dish the way those green bell peppers do. And then, of course, there's the tomato finds from last year. Crimson Carmelo, Cosmonaut Volkov, Vorlon, red currant, little tiny thing. And then I would be forced to stop myself. Well, we're going to be back with tofu for people who think they hate tofu, and a soy sauce showdown. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Have you tasted fresh-made tofu? Creamy, rich tofu pudding kind of fresh tofu? Or better yet, have you ever taken a shot at making it yourself? I predict this will be a new weekend warrior project. Asian cookbook author Andrea Nguyen has a real handholder guide to homemade tofu and a lot more in her new book, Asian Tofu. Andrea, good to have you with us.
Thanks so much, Lynn.
Really fresh tofu is another world, right?
It absolutely is. You know, when I started making it a couple of years ago, I was just completely blown away. It's like the difference between mozzarella that is, you know, vacuum-packed in plastic and the fresh stuff, or, you know, ricotta in a tub versus ricotta that you make yourself.
How do you do this?
It's, you know, you get good soybeans, non-GMO organic soybeans, and then good water, water that you want to drink. You know, not just like any old water, and then coagulant. And the coagulant can be any a different kind of salt or acid. You can use Japanese nigari, which is really like cooked down seawater, mm-hmm. or gypsum, which people use to make beer with, or even lemon juice or vinegar.
Okay, so you get the soybeans, you soak them in water. About how long?
You know, it really depends on the air temperature, and it. I leave them overnight, and they can go from, I don't know, anywhere from 12 to 16 hours, depending on what the temperature is.
Okay, so do the beans actually get soft?
No, they're weird because soybeans start out being round shape, and then they expand to look like, you know, a kidney bean almost, but they're very small, and
right.
And this beautiful buttercup yellow color.
And then do you cook them at this point?
No, you grind them up in a blender or a food processor until you get almost like a milkshake kind of texture. And then you cook it up and, you know, use a nonstick pot because that soy bean mixture, the slurry, is really tough to clean up. So I always say, you know, like if you got a nonstick pot around, use it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then at this point, the coagulant goes into it.
Well, no, actually, you strain it through a cloth because
right.
you want to squeeze out the actual soy milk itself. You know, the stuff that people think of like that's coming in a box kind of stuff. But the
right.
stuff you make at home is going to taste a gazillion times better.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, you strain it, you squeeze out the milk, and then you cook the soy milk a second time. Soy milk has to get cooked because that makes the soy milk easier to digest.
And when does the coagulant go in?
The coagulant goes in after the second cooking, and the coagulant gets added in very slowly. And so, you know, what you're doing is adding this coagulant and separating the soy milk into curds and whey. And the curds are basically the protein and fats that are in the soy milk itself.
So it's basically like making cheese.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. You have, you know, this separation that occurs in the pot, and
right.
then you you just use a spoon to kind of spoon out those soft curds, and they can be just these beautifully pillowy soft curds that you can put into a mold, or you can just put it in a colander and line whatever mold you have with a little piece of muslin,
mm-hmm.
So that it's easier to remove, and then the whey naturally drains through. You can even just spoon that stuff, the curds, up and put it into a small bowl for what the Japanese call oboro tofu. And that naturally settles And then at the end of that, while it's still warm, my God, a little, you know, soy sauce, or even if you want a little bit of, you know, Maldon salt and olive oil, even if you want to push it that direction, is absolutely fabulous, because the tofu develops what the Japanese call umami. And it's just sensational tasting.
So how long will it keep at this point?
At this point, it will keep for about a week. But when you make fresh tofu, you want to eat it, you know, like within a, you can eat it the day of. It's absolutely fabulous. The next day, it's fabulous. Change the water every other day if you are going to keep it around.
So, and then to actually cook with it, you can, what, marinate it? You can saute it?
You can do a lot of things with tofu. People, you know, think that tofu has to be treated gently. And if you're going to make fresh tofu, yes, treat it gently, eat it just, you know, I call it eat it naked, just with a few garnishes, a little ginger, a little, you know, soy sauce, and, you know, keep it simple. But with tofu that you want to actually cook, you can just simply cube it up and simmer it in sauce, such as, you know, there's a dish called Mapo Tofu, which is like on practically every single Chinese restaurant menu. It's a spicy Sichuan dish. And that's just cubed tofu that is simmered in a very spicy, earthy sauce with Sichuan peppercorns to finish it. Or you can, with different kinds of tofu, such as pressed tofu, which is a lot firmer and a lot meatier, you can just slice those things up into thin pieces or sticks and stir fry them so that, you know, you don't have to even drain any water. Some kinds of tofu, cut it into slabs, marinate it, and grill it. Make a little tofu sandwich. Put some bacon on that thing, because tofu is not a vegetarian food.
Andrea, thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Lynn.
Andrea Nguyen's latest book is Asian Tofu. Now, the ideal initiation, I think, is her recipe for silken tofu and creamy edamame soup. It's on the website, splendidtable.org. Dollars spent, soy sauce is a cook's bargain, which is exactly why I wanted to do a soy sauce tasting. This is one of the things you've got to have in your kitchen arsenal. Why? Well, soy sauce is packed with umami. That's that substance that lifts the flavors of everything it touches. But not all soy sauces are created equal. So, what makes a fine soy sauce? Well, it's cultured, it has a starter, and it's aged. Sometimes for several years, which is why you can find soys in Asian shops selling for double figures. Now, on the flip side, there are soys made without a soybean in sight. But the key question here is, can you actually taste the difference? Well, our producer went out to a supermarket and picked up 5 national brands, including some organic ones, and then we dug in. Okay, number one. Going to take a sniff first. Not a bad aroma. Very, well, it's salty, obviously, but I can't quite explain it, but it's overpowering in the mouth. It's not bad, but it's just not great. All right. Number two. This actually has a meaty undertone. It has a wine-like quality. Okay. Number three. No, too strong for me. All right. Number four. So after tasting every one of those soy sauces, I realized that soy sauces are tough to taste. I mean, between the soybean and the salt, you feel like your tongue is pickled. Well, after all of the trials and tribulations, I did pick one soy sauce that I liked above all the others, and it reminded me of mushrooms and sake. The soy sauce is Kikkoman. And yes, this is the Kikkoman you can find in every supermarket in North America. Well, you can watch a video of the tasting, and you can get the names of all the competitors that didn't make the cut on the website, splendidtable.org. There is a service for all you road warriors, you who work nonstop all day only to wind up at some bad overpriced place for supper. Well, next time, before heading out, check out Jane and Michael Stern's roadfood.com. They report on great down-home local eats there and here. Hey, Jane, Michael, welcome back, guys. Hey, Lynn.
Hi, Lynn.
So what have you guys been eating?
We have been eating cream chip beef, sausage gravy biscuits, scrapple with grits, and fabulous fried shrimp. So based on that,
guess where
it's
we
probably
were.
Pretty easy to say we were on the eastern shore of Virginia. And I have to say we were eating sweet potatoes, you know, which they grow there. And many of the restaurants make a big deal of sweet potatoes. And where we were eating all this good stuff is a fabulous road food place called the Exmoor Diner. And it's a real old-fashioned, you know, chrome and formica diner with a monitor roof and booths and a counter where everybody in town gathers to talk about events, have coffee together, and eat some really good soul food.
So where is this exactly?
On the eastern shore of Maryland.
On the eastern shore of Virginia.
Oh.
Could you guys decide which state you were in?
Sorry.
In the town of Exmoor.
I'm so obsessed with this place because I love it so much, and I love the shrimp pancake.
Yes.
You know, that wonderful, I've never seen that before. It's almost like an egg foo young of shrimp, but it's not. It's chopped shrimp that have been griddle fried into this very thin pancake. Very unique, very different.
And, of course, they have oysters. They have seaside and bayside oysters. You can get really weird local stuff like fried drumfish ribs. You can get puffers, you know, which are those, like, those blowfish that are actually edible. They're little pan-fried fish that are real sweet
and
good.
They're pretty big, actually.
But they're small enough you can have a few on a plate. And, you know, you get real mashed potatoes or the great sweet potatoes, greens, braised cabbage on the side. It's a combination local seafood, eastern shore produce, and traditional soul food restaurant.
So this is the leatherette booths.
Yep.
And the stools at the chrome-trimmed formica counter.
And cream
you
chip
got it.
Beef. You know, years and years ago, Michael and I wrote a book called Square Meals. And one of the chapters in the book was about army food. And actually, cream chip beef is probably one of the few things that were classic army food that still is served, and it's wonderful if it's done correctly.
You find a lot of it in the mid-Atlantic states.
But you have to explain, what is cream chip beef?
It's dried beef in a kind of cream, kind of a peppery cream sauce, the kind of sauce you'd put on biscuits. And in fact, very often the beef in this cream sauce is indeed served on biscuits or toast.
Yeah, it's usually, you know, army lingo was SOS on
stuff
a
on a shingle.
Yes.
What's good about it is that it's a balance in that the beef and the gravy can have a lot of spice, but it's also creamy. So it's that great sort of yin yang of extremely kind of creamy comfort food, but spiciness as well.
Guys, it sounds great.
It's good.
Yeah. Thank you, guys.
Bye.
Bye, Lynn.
Jane and Michael Stern are the creators of roadfood.com. Now you can find information on their picks at splendidtable.org.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me. Don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's late, but just call me. Tell me and I'll be around.
When it seems it is time to turn to your calls, pick up the phone, 800-537-5252. Find us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org. We've got Carol on the line from Wexford, Pennsylvania. Carol, what is on your mind?
Hi, I was calling. Our family was visiting relatives up in Door County, Wisconsin this summer, and we visited one of those oil and vinegar tasting stores, and we bought some 18-year-old balsamic vinegar, and we just loved it. We've put it on so many different things, even that green soup that you had the recipe for.
Oh, yeah. Anna Thomas's green soup.
Yeah, it was delicious. And with a little bit of olive oil and just mix that in, it was so good.
Mm-hmm.
I was just wondering, it's certainly different from other vinegars, and I was kind of curious as to how it is made, because it has a thickness to it that regular vinegar doesn't have.
Oh, dear. I do a half hour on this, Carol.
Uh-oh.
So I'll try to give you the short version. Okay.
Okay.
All right. Okay. Real balsamic vinegar, the true stuff, is made in a specific part of Italy, in northern Italy, the Emilia-Romagna region. And it's made really in a very specific part of Emilia-Romagna around the city of Modena and the neighboring city of Reggio. And what it is made from, it's made differently than other vinegars. It's made from the boiled down grape juice of wine grapes. And it's aged in barrels. And it is not made from actual wine. So what they do is they take this grape juice pressed from wine grapes before it actually turns into, you know, alcohol. Mm-hmm. And they put it in these barrels. And every barrel already has some of the vinegar in it.
Oh.
Okay. And the barrels, there's a big barrel, then a smaller barrel, and then a smaller barrel, and a smaller barrel. So every year, the littlest barrel gets some vinegar taken from it, and then it gets topped off. Okay. So what they do is they top it off with vinegar from the slightly bigger barrel. And then they top that one off from the vinegar from that slightly bigger barrel. And they go up the line until they get to the last barrel, which maybe holds, let's say, 10 gallons. Or, you know, it's not a huge barrel. And that's what they top off with the vinegar from last year's pressing of the grape juice.
Oh, I see.
So your 18-year-old vinegar may have come from a barrel that has, you know, grape juice in it from like 60 years ago.
Really?
Yeah, and it gets thick, and believe it or not, this puppy can be aged hundreds of years.
Really?
Well, because it's this constant mix in the barrel, and when you get to the really wildly good stuff, which is tasted by master tasters, and it's only bottled in these special bottles, and on the label it'll say Tradizionale, that stuff, they say it's 25 years old, but really it can be quite, you know, centuries old. And that stuff can sell for $200 for 3.5 ounces.
Oh, my goodness. That's gold.
That's gold. And you use it by the drop. But you've gotten a hint of how intense it can be.
Yeah.
And how fabulous it can be. And by the way, that stuff isn't salad dressing. That stuff is literally like a sauce. You put a few drops on a dish. So, yes. But now I do have a cheater's thing for you. It's not the equivalent of the phenomenal stuff. But you could take a good, inexpensive balsamic vinegar, boil it down with a little bit of brown sugar. So you figure for a cup of balsamic, you want maybe 3 tablespoons of brown sugar. And this is what chefs do in restaurants, you know, when they streak the plate with the balsamic.
Yes.
You boil it down until it's a bit syrupy, and you will get some of that thick viscosity. But what you bought was obviously very good quality, more of the everyday balsamic. But if you want to cheat a little and save some money, you could use that trick.
Oh, that's very interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's the short version. I will not bore you with the half hour or hour long lecture that I have been known to do on occasion.
Well, I appreciate that.
You are welcome. But it's a fascinating vinegar. It's not made like many other vinegars in the world. And it's now being copied everywhere. Newark, New Jersey probably is making balsamic vinegar.
Okay.
So thanks for calling, Carol.
Thank you.
Enjoy it. Bye. Well, the weekly trivia challenge is up, and the question is, what is the connection between going to the movies today and eating in Peru 7,000 years ago? Well, we'll be back with that answer, and you and I will talk. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. We're going to be talking with you in a moment, so get in touch. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org or call us 800-537-5252. But before we talk, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what is the connection between going to the movies today and eating in Peru 7,000 years ago? Popcorn. That's the connection. Peruvians were popping it 7,000 years ago, but without the salt and the butter. This is a new discovery by a team from the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History. What is exciting here is how fast corn evolved and what that means ultimately to biodiversity. 9,000 years ago, the first corn was a wild grass in Mexico with a few seeds at its tip. 2,000 years later, and that's pretty fast for plant evolution, it was a full cob and was being popped by the Peruvians something like 2,000 or 3,000 miles away. Now, the challenge here for scientists is tracking how corn went from that grass to the hundreds of varieties today. Now, figure out how those varieties came about, and you have got a wealth of biomaterial in the proverbial plant bank. But corn is tricky. You see, cobs didn't survive in the humidity of Central and South America, and this is why Peru's corn is so important. You could call it the missing link. Okay, back to your calls. Let's talk. You can reach us at 800-537-5252 or friend us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, send us an email, splendidtable.org. Evan's on the line from Boston. Hi, Evan.
Hi, Lynn. I would like to talk today about cake. Birthday cake in particular.
Uh-huh.
So I am 23, turning 24, and every year my mom and my dad come visit me.
Right.
And my mom is an incredibly good baker. She's amazing. And she makes me a birthday cake every year. And it's always fantastic. It's always, like, the best cake you've ever had. But I'm kind of tired a little bit. I hate to say it. I'm kind of tired of, like, chocolate cake or vanilla cake. So I wanted to ask you, I was thinking of maybe having her make me something more seasonal, something a little bit more, if I may say, daring, like a daring cake. Something that's a little bit more off the cuff.
Off the cuff. Okay. How about a chocolate chili cake?
Ooh, what is that?
Well, that's essentially her great chocolate cake with a good amount of chili added, along with maybe, if we're going to go the whole Mexican route, some cinnamon and black pepper. And she could take maybe a half teaspoon of some hot chili. I mean, she could go the cayenne route, which is pretty strong. She could do a quarter to a half teaspoon. And I would check this. I would go to something like Epicurious. And what she'll get there is she should use her recipe. Because from what you're saying, her recipes are just dynamite.
Yeah, they're dynamite.
But that'll give her her proportion of what amount of chili to add to basically, you know, the kind of cake she does.
Okay.
But I would say for me, a half a teaspoon of a nice hot chili thrown in there with some cinnamon, because the cinnamon really, you know, is gorgeous with that.
That sounds absolutely fantastic.
Just, you know, suggest go to Epicurious. I think she's going to love it, and you're going to love it, and it'll give you the edge you want.
So, oh, wow. Well,
and you have a great birthday.
Thank you. That's a great birthday gift to me, so thank you, Lynn.
You're welcome, Evan. Happy birthday.
Thanks so much.
Bye. You can reach us at 800-537-5252 or follow us on Facebook or send us an email, splendidtable.org. We have Madeline on the line from New Orleans. Madeline, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about my herbs. My daughter's finally got me into growing some herbs, and I've really enjoyed using things like lemon verbena and dill and basil. But I planted one that I don't know anything about, and I'm hoping you can give me some uses for it. It's sweet lavender.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's one of my favorites. First of all, rub it all over yourself and you'll smell wonderful.
Yes.
Isn't it just great?
It is, but I don't know how to eat it.
Well, it's not something you eat a lot of, but the fact is it's one of the traditional ingredients in a mixture called Herbes de Provence, you know, in the southern part of France, because it grows wild there. And what that mixture is, it, you know, varies from cook to cook, but basically it's thyme and lavender and oregano, and basil, and savory. And you don't have to have all of those things. But when you put that together and you kind of do it according to your nose and your taste, that's one thing to do with it. The other thing is any dessert, like a cake, you know, if you're making a pound cake or anything like that, mix a tablespoon of lavender into the batter. It just is wonderful. If you're doing anything like a panna cotta or anything creamy or an ice cream, infuse the milk or the cream with lavender. In so many words, warm it and add a generous amount of lavender as though you were making tea, you know?
Yeah.
Let it sit about 10, 15 minutes, then strain it out until so you have a nice scent of lavender coming off of that, and then go on with the recipe. And then the other thing you can do is put some lavender in your sugar that you're going to use for baking, baking cookies and that kind of thing. And then strain it out. In sugar cookies, as in anything you're going to use with vanilla. Lavender is wonderful with lemon. Lavender is great with things like anything flavored with almond. If you're doing any kind of almond cake or that kind of thing, it's utterly delicious. So think anything creamy, you know, anything that's like the sugar cookie, the shortbread, that kind of thing. So now you've got a whole lavender selection going for you.
Yes.
So you enjoy that lavender.
I definitely will, with a lot more ways to do it now.
You take
Thanks
care, Madeline.
Thanks a lot, Les.
Bye. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Check us out on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, splendidtable.org. We got a shout out on Twitter from Sandra, who wants to know if I've got any creative ideas for using her 4 cups of deliciously spicy ginger simple syrup. And by the way, simple syrup is when you just melt together sugar, equal parts of sugar and water. Well, okay, Sandra. First of all, that's going to probably keep in the fridge for maybe a month or more, so you don't have to be in any hurry. You can add seltzer water and put that over ice, and you've got a great non-alcoholic drink. But, of course, there's rum, and rum was made for this kind of thing. The other thing is you've got the base of ginger ale, except I'd probably throw in a lot more ginger. And I'd probably do some lime zest and fresh lime in there just for kicks because it gives it a tart snap. The other thing is you can take this and freeze it and make a ginger sorbet. You know, throw it into an ice cream maker. And you're on your way to ginger sorbet. I think would be great to add some chili and maybe a tad of fish sauce and a lot of lime juice. And now you have got essentially a dressing for rice noodle salads. You've got a marinade for anything from Southeast Asia. And you could use it for saucing things like grilled shrimp. So I think those are a few ideas that you can work with. And thanks. We've got Beth calling from South Hadley, Massachusetts. Beth, hi.
Hi, Lynn.
What do you want to talk about?
Well, one of my dear friends from high school is now a Black Hawk pilot, and she has deployed to Kuwait for the next year.
Right.
And I really would like to make something to send her that's sweet and something that is savory that will withstand the flight, the heat in Kuwait, and however long it's going to sit there before she knows it's there. And I have no clue what to do. I know fudge is out, but I don't know what else to make.
Well, no, but I'm thinking of, you know, there's, I mean, boy, a ginger snap can take anything. You know, a ginger snap never dies, especially if you seal it airtight. And the cookie idea, the reason why people go to cookies is they work well.
I figured,
Yeah, and one of the reasons I like spice cookies is that they really hold up well. And, you know, the perennial thing about the ginger snap and that sort of thing is that you can go in a lot of directions. And one of the things I like to do with ginger snaps is I do them with 3 kinds of ginger. Fresh ginger, candied ginger, which you get chunks of, and then, of course, the dried ginger.
I've never done that.
Try that. Take any good ginger snap recipe and add some grated fresh ginger and then cut up some candied ginger, and you're off and running on that.
Okay.
Now, as far as the savory side, I'm thinking about how about some homemade crackers?
That sounds good.
Because I'm thinking homemade crackers, you could do a spicy cracker for her, and they really hold up.
Okay.
And a homemade cracker is made a lot of the way you make a cookie.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but what it's without sugar. You've got salt, and you could do something that you might have with some herbs.
Okay,
how about black pepper with rosemary?
Oh, Oh, that sounds nice.
Doesn't it sound fabulous? Black pepper, rosemary, a little bit of thyme, and some garlic, okay? And you would take, look up some cracker recipes, all right?
Would you use fresh or dried herbs?
I would use a combination.
Okay.
Yeah, because one will complement the other. And usually what happens is with a cracker dough, what you do is you work it fairly well. So you want a little bit of fat in there. Mm-hmm. And usually that's a bit of butter. Okay. Flour, a bit of milk. Okay. A little bit of baking powder. And you're going to find a recipe for this, but I'm just going to give you the basics on this. Okay. And then the herbs, a bit of fresh garlic, the black pepper. And then you roll that out and you really let it rest in the fridge for a while.
Okay.
And you roll it out kind of thin, and then you roll it back on itself.
Mm-hmm.
And then you roll it out again, and you roll it back on itself. And you let it sit on the fridge between each rolling. So you build up these kind of layers. And some people like to brush each layer with a little bit of butter. And then you get it rolled really thin. You chill it. You cut it into pieces, and then you bake it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And the other thing you could do are cheese sticks. And they'll hold.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You are welcome. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Check us out on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, splendidtable.org. You know, the other side of the sushi that we pick up at the takeout counter is the subject of a quiet and fascinating documentary, Jiro Dreams of Sushi. Jiro Ono is 85, and he's considered the finest sushi maker in the world. His life has been about finding this perfection in sushi above everything else. His sushi bar is in what looks like a subway tunnel of an office building. There are only 10 seats, and you wait months to get one. Director David Gelb follows Jiro as he works with his son and talks about his life. David, good to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you.
So, David, tell us about Jiro-san. Who is he?
Well, Jiro is he's a sushi chef who works in the basement of an office building in Tokyo, and he's known by chefs around the world as being the world's greatest sushi chef. He's 86 years old now, and he was a child during a Great Depression in Japan, and his parents could not afford to support him, and so they essentially told him, go get a job, and you're on your own from now on. So he became an apprentice at a restaurant and had to work incredibly hard just to survive, because there were many young people who also needed jobs, and if he were to screw up, they would have kicked him out. So ever since he was young, he's had to work incredibly hard, you know, just to survive. And he's only discovered his talents, you know, years into his apprenticeship, and grew to truly love what he does.
And from watching the film, There's no gimmick. I mean, we think of sushi in this country and we think of rolls and combinations, but he's doing fish and rice.
Yes. This is the great misunderstanding about sushi. And that is that, you know, nigiri is the traditional Tokyo style of sushi, which is where the fish is on top of the rice, and it's kind of the classic appearance of sushi. And these large rolls, like your California rolls and your Philadelphia rolls and things like this, these are all American creations. But sushi is a lot more than just fish and rice. And Jiro, through decades and decades of trial and error, has managed to create the perfect balance between the rice and the fish in the temperature of the rice, the type of the rice, the process of the cooking of the rice, which is cooked in a very high-pressure situation. And the preparation of the fish as well requires years and years of experience and trial and error to age it just the right amount, to marinate it for the perfect amount of time and in the perfect type of vinegar. If they're marinating in vinegar, they salt some of it. Some of it is simply aged in a refrigerator for the appropriate amount of time. And so all of these factors come together to produce what is really the perfect bite.
It was interesting to see in the film 10 years of apprenticeship, the people who work in his kitchen, before they could make an omelet. The amount of perfectionism that's at work in that kitchen. And Judo San does not seem to be someone who is extraordinarily open. What was the most difficult part of the process?
I would say that the most difficult part was the language barrier between myself and Jiro and Yoshikazu.
Yoshikazu is his son.
Yoshikazu-san is Jiro's son, yes. But getting them to accept me and to allow me to make the film was actually easier than I thought it would be, and this is all thanks to Yamamoto-san, who is the food critic who appears in the film as something of a narrator. He convinced Jiro-san that I would be the right guy to make this kind of movie, simply because I came in as a blank slate, and you know, I had no agenda specifically other than to kind of tell the story of Jiro and Yoshikazu as from their perspective. And I've just, you know, learned that, you know, kind of patience is the key to earning the trust of your subject. And I managed to find a way to embed myself into their daily routine, but without influencing them or distracting them.
I found myself, as I was watching the film unfold and seeing the level of dedication that Jiro-san had for his work, he lived and breathed sushi and demanded that of his son, and I felt rather sorry for his son. It didn't seem his son had any choice about what his life was going to be.
Well, Jiro-san once said that sometimes you don't choose your job, and your job chooses you. And Yoshikazu, you know, there are many things that he wanted to do. He wanted to be a race car driver, and he wanted to be a fighter jet pilot.
Yeah.
But I think that he is very proud to be where he is and to do what he's doing by the side of his father.
Well, David, thank you for talking with us, and great good fortune with the film.
Thank you so much.
David Gelb is director of the documentary Jiro Dreams of Sushi. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Have a great week, and until next time, let me leave you with this from the French novelist Colette, who said, "The lovesick, the betrayed, and the jealous all smell alike." Splendid Table is produced by APM American Public Media. Take a look at splendidtable.org for additional information on anything you heard here today. Get registered for our monthly book giveaway, download our weekly podcast, take a visit to our online store, and don't miss our newest publication, a quarterly ebook, Eating In with Lynn. You're going to find all that information at splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Jennifer Larson. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz with help from Laura Kalibi. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.